Welcome to Four Winds Fellowships. I'm Pastor Tim Warner. We are in our module number two, dealing with the nature of God and His Son. And we are in section D. In this section, we are dealing with some of the primary exegetical errors made by so-called biblical Unitarians in their attempts to deny the pre-human existence of the Son of God. So this is our third episode in this section. In this episode, I want to take a look at 1 Peter 1:20, which is really where many of these people sort of begin in their attempt to claim that the pre-existence language in Scripture deals only with an alleged pre-existence in the mind of God or in the plan of God, as opposed to an actual substantive pre-existence. And so, of course, Anthony Buzzard is one of the main proponents of this view. He's written some books on the topic. Others have written books on the topic. But this is kind of where they start when they're going to deal with this topic. They start with 1 Peter 1:20. And the attempt is made to show that in the same way that Christians allegedly were foreknown in the mind and plan of God, that Peter uses the same language of Jesus himself as being only foreknown in the mind of God or the plan of God and not in his actual existence as a distinct person. So I've titled this section, John Calvin's Ghost Haunts Biblical Unitarianism. And the reason I've titled it that is because what you will see as we proceed is that the defenders of this view use the Calvinistic interpretation of certain terms and certain passages in the Bible in order to project this Calvinistic idea of predetermining someone's destiny. You know, Calvinists teach that Christians have been foreknown by God before creation, that God knew every person, that God predetermined who would be saved and who would be lost. And in the same way, he predetermined that his son, or that he would have a son in at some point in the future. And of course, they put that at his birth in Bethlehem. And so that just as Christians supposedly are pre-selected, predetermined by God before they exist, so also this applies to the Son. And the passage that they start with to prove this point, or allegedly prove this point, is 1 Peter 1:20. So I have it here on the screen. I'm going to read it from the New American Standard Version, and then I'm going to read it from the LGV, Last Generation Version. And there's a slight and a subtle difference, but the thing I want you to understand is that the interpretation that we're going to give is not dependent on the Last Generation Version specifically. It's dependent on showing that the term foreknow or foreknowledge, as it's used in the Bible, never ever means what Calvinists claim it means, and therefore cannot be used to support Anthony Buzzard's argument. All right, so let's read 1 Peter 1:20 from the New American Standard Version. It says, "For he," that is Christ in the context, "for he was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but has appeared in these last times for the sake of you." In the LGV, it says, "having been known formerly, indeed, even before the casting down of the world, yet made apparent in the last times for you." Now, here is Anthony Buzzard's quote from his book on the Trinity, Christianity's Self-Inflicted Wound. And this is his comment on this passage. He says, "Most significantly, the view that Jesus existed prior to his birth only in the counsels of God, that is only as a figment of God's imagination and not in reality, is one expressed by Peter in his first epistle. At the end of his career, he has not changed the view expressed in his early speeches in Acts. And of course, that's actually not correct. Peter's speeches do not deny the preexistence, the literal preexistence of the Son. They don't deal with the topic at all. But anyway, he says, Jesus was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but manifest in the last days for you, 1 Peter 1:20. E.G. Selwyn notes correctly, quote, nor are we entitled to say that Peter was familiar with the idea of Christ's preexistence, for this idea is not necessarily implied in his description of Christ as foreknown before the foundation of the world, since Christians also are objects of God's foreknowledge. All of the faithful were similarly foreknown, 1 Peter 1:2, but this obviously does not mean they preexisted. All right, so the thing to understand about Buzzard's point is, again, he is assuming the Calvinistic view that Christians, that every person who will ever be saved, was foreknown and predetermined by God before he created anything. All right, that's the Calvinistic view. And he is imposing that now on 1 Peter 1:20. All right, so let's look here at section 1. Buzzard's interpretation is based on the erroneous Calvinistic understanding of the terms foreknow and foreknowledge as they're used throughout the Bible. The verb foreknow is prognosko, and the noun form which is foreknowledge is prognosis, from which we get our English word prognosis. It's important to know that this does not mean, when it's used of persons in the Bible every time, it does not mean to know someone before they exist in reality. All right, this is the way the Calvinists use the term. It's a compound of pro, which means before or prior, previously, formerly, and the word for know, gnosis. It's a verb, all right? Often used of intimate relationships. So the verb to know, like Adam knew his wife Eve. Okay, so it's not he had prior knowledge of her, but he had an intimate relationship with his wife Eve. Okay, when it's used of persons, it always refers, and this is without exception, it always refers to a former relationship with a person who existed at the time. The Septuagint has one example of this in The Wisdom of Solomon, which is a book that's not included in our Old Testament, but it was included in the Septuagint in Wisdom 6:13. In the New Testament, use the persons again. It's found in Acts 26:5, Romans 8:29, Romans 11:2, and 1 Peter 1:20. When it's used of events, not persons, it always refers to having been forewarned or foreplanned. Now, the problem here is that Buzzard's interpretation and use of the term is he is borrowing from the meaning of the word whenever it's used of events. The problem here is that it's never used that way of persons. All right, with persons, it always refers to a former relationship with a person. And the former aspect of it is before now, or before when the speaker is speaking or he is writing his book. It's before the present from the speaker or writer's perspective, not before the person existed in time. All right, and this is the error that Buzzard and all of the biblical Unitarians make when they interpret this passage in 1 Peter 1:20. I'm going to demonstrate that from the texts themselves, all right? So whenever it's used of events, it always refers to having been foreplanned or forewarned. And we see this in the Septuagint in Wisdom of Solomon 8:8, 18:6, in Judith 9:6, and Judith 11:17. In all of these, it's referring to events, not to persons. That is, being forewarned of events or foreplanning of events, not not referring to persons. In the New Testament, it's used in Acts 2:23 and 2 Peter 3:17 with regard to events. And again, it always has this meaning. All right, so you need to be aware that what biblical Unitarians are doing is they are taking the usage of this term, and Calvinists also, because they're simply borrowing Calvinistic interpretations. They are borrowing the way the terms are used with regard to events and projecting them onto persons. And the Bible never does that. All right. The Bible always distinguishes when these terms are used of persons, that it always refers to a former relationship with the actual person who existed at the time. All right. Whether we're talking about either the verb prognosko or the noun prognosis. All right. Either way, it's always the same. All right. Now, so we're going to look at the various usage in the Bible of these terms. All right. So prognosko, the verb, meaning for know, and prognosis, foreknowledge, when it's used of persons. Those are the ones we're going to examine. And these are every case where either the noun or the verb refers to persons being foreknown. So in Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 6, verse 13, in the Septuagint, I have here the NET's translation. That's the New English Translation Septuagint. It's available online if you look it up. So it says, wisdom anticipates those who set their desire on her to make herself known in advance. Now, these words here, known in advance, are translated from prognosko, right? For know. All right. Now, what's important here in this passage is that what it's saying is that wisdom, and of course, it's using wisdom as a metaphor, as a personification here, but of course there's the deeper meaning with regard to Christ, which we've dealt with in the previous section of this module. But leaving that aside for now, let's just suppose it's being used as a personification of wisdom. And so what this verse is saying is that by anticipating a person's desire for godly wisdom, that is, wisdom is anticipating a person's desire to have godly wisdom. Therefore, wisdom then makes herself known in advance, that is, in advance to that person. All right, that is, before they're actually asking for it. Wisdom makes herself known to that person. So what we see here is that the person is real. The person is a person desiring wisdom. And wisdom is making herself known in advance to that person. So wisdom is being portrayed as a person making herself known to a person who is desiring this wisdom that is known in advance, that is prior to that person specifically asking for wisdom. Now, if you go to the Wisdom of Solomon in the Septuagint and read this chapter in advance, read this chapter in its context, it is quite clear that that's what wisdom is doing, making herself known in advance of the person actually asking for the wisdom. All right, but again, it's portrayed as a personal relationship between two entities, right? You can argue that one's a personification, but that's irrelevant to the point or to the definition of the term. All right. Now, let's go to the next passage, which is in Acts chapter 26. And this is the one that I think is probably the most weighty in understanding this term, prognosko, this verb. All right. Paul uses this verb in Acts chapter 26 in one of his speeches where he's being accused. So Acts 26, 4 and 5, he's defending himself. He says, my manner of life from my youth, which was spent from the beginning, and note that word, those words, from the beginning, among my own nation at Jerusalem, all the Jews know They knew me from the first. Now, these words, knew me from the first, are translated from prognosko. So what Paul is defining the term for us, and he's putting it in a situation with regard to his own life, his own life. Now, the Jews who were accusing him knew him from his youth, he says here, right? And from the beginning, that is from the beginning of his activity, his religious activity. They knew me from my youth and from the beginning among my own nation at Jerusalem. All the Jews know they knew me from the first, prognosko. All right, so Paul is saying his accusers knew him and his activity and what he was involved with from the very beginning, and he uses prognosko to describe their foreknowledge of Paul. Now, what's critical about this statement is that it's perfectly clear that the Calvinistic interpretation of prognosko, that is to know someone before they exist, is false. It cannot work in this passage. And anytime you have a context or a passage that's where a term is being used where the common definition of that term is clearly falsified, that's proven that it cannot work in this situation, what that proves is that that meaning for the term is false. It's not within the scope of the usage of the term. And that's how we determine definitions of words. That's how lexicons determine definitions of words. It is by their usage. All right, so he says, they knew me from the first, prognosko, if they were willing to testify that according to the strict sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. All right, so again, all of Paul's accusers foreknew Paul from the beginning, from his youth, this personal relationship with Paul, interaction with him, and the observation of Paul, or Saul, from his youth, was not some kind of premonition or predetermination or plan concerning him before he existed, right? It was after he existed, and it was a relationship that they had with Paul, even from his youth. He was brought up in the Jewish traditions under Gamaliel, right? He was taught under Gamaliel. So the Pharisees were very familiar with Paul from his youth and from all his zeal and his religious activity and his education and all of those things. They were familiar with him. So again, prognosko means, in this context, absolutely means to know someone personally after they began to exist, all right? To have a relationship with them, to have intimate knowledge of them as they already exist. That's the critical point. All right, so let's look at the next passage where this verb is used, is in Romans chapter 8, verses 28 through 30. Here in the New King James Version, it says, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose, for whom he foreknew," prognosko, and this is in the aorist tense, past tense, "he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he predestined, these he also called. Whom he called, these he justified. Whom he justified, these he also glorified." Now, this is one of Calvinism's favorite proof texts, because what they say is that all of the things that follow, all these verbs that follow, predestined, called, justified, glorified, all of these verbs follow from those whom God foreknew. Again, a Calvinist, when he sees foreknew or prognosko, he is projecting this back into eternity past and God supposing having knowledge of people before they existed. And so what Calvinists do is they take this passage and say that therefore God foreknew people before they existed, therefore God predetermined their ultimate outcome, their ultimate destiny, and he then, after he predetermined it, he called them, and after he called them, he justified them, and after he justifies them, he also will glorify them ultimately in the resurrection. What is wrong with that interpretation? Besides the fact that the word foreknew, we have just shown that their definition of this word foreknew, prognosko, is falsified by the previous passage. So the critical thing to understand about the Calvinist interpretation of this verse is that all of these verbs are in the aorist indicative in Greek, which means they are speaking of historical events. They're speaking of the past. They're all speaking of the past. None of them are speaking of the present. Now, as I pointed out, these are all aorist indicative verbs pointing to historical events. If they were to be understood as Calvinists understand them, that is, this is what God is doing currently, which would have to use the present indicative, and usually they use the present sense with what's referred to as a nomic sense. A nomic sense is the present tense used with the idea that this is what God does, that is, on a continual basis, not necessarily right now. Of course, it would include right now, but it's like this is what always happens, okay? Or what, in this case, what God always does. That's the nomic sense of the present tense in Greek. But that's not what is used here. He's not using the present tense, so it does not have a nomic sense, all right? He's referring to past events, past historical events. Let me back up here, right? Those God foreknew, he predestined in the past. He called them in the past. He justified them in the past. He glorified them in the past. Again, glorified is an aorist indicative verb. It's a past historical event. So what is he talking about in this passage? He's not talking about what God does for his elect or Christians. He's talking about what God did for those who he knew personally in the Old Testament, that is, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David, the prophets. These people, who the ones in the past that God knew personally, just like we showed, the meaning of prognosko means to have knowledge of someone intimately as they already exist, as a person, right? Those whom God knew, foreknew, he knew previous to now. Again, this is what foreknow means. It means previous to now, not before they existed. All right, those whom God foreknew, he predestined. That is, he predetermined. So the ones God knew in the past, let's take Abraham as our example of one of the ones God foreknew, right? He foreknew him during his lifetime because he had a personal relationship with him. He appeared to him. He spoke with him. Abraham obeyed his voice, and so forth, right? So he foreknew him. So he, by knowing him personally, right? God knows the hearts of all people. So by knowing Abraham personally, by observing Abraham, God foreknew him. And because of Abraham's heart, Abraham's devotion, God predetermined that this man, that he would choose that man to be conformed to the image of his son. And he will, and he was conformed to the image of Christ. Right? So he also called Abraham. We have the history of God calling Abraham to leave his homeland and go to the place where he would later receive as an inheritance. We have been called to the same thing as Hebrews 11 indicates. He justified Abraham and he glorified Abraham. Now, in what way did God do those things to Abraham? I'm gonna skip down here to the footnotes just so that you can see the reference here. Abraham was called. Hebrews 11:8 makes that point. Abraham was justified. Romans 4:2-3 make that point, as well as James 2:23-24 make the same point. Abraham was then glorified, that is, given a place of honor. That's what the word glorified means. It means to be honored, okay? To be exalted. And Abraham was, excuse me, honored and exalted by God. And we see this in Genesis 12:2-3. All right, so all of those things apply to Abraham. Paul was simply making an analysis in this passage in Romans 28 through 30. This passage uses or points to examples in the Old Testament historical record of men whom God had a personal relationship with and what he did to those whom he predetermined to be conformed to the image of his son. Now what Paul does, if you read verses 28 through 30, is Paul takes that analogy by pointing his readers, you know, he starts out by saying all things work together. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God, right? To those who are called according to his purpose. And then he points us back to the Old Testament as illustrations of that, right? Men like Abraham and so forth, whom God knew personally in the past and how God has brought them along because we have this historical record of their lives and God's interaction with them in the past. And so there, and then he takes in verses 29 and 30, he takes that as evidence that God will do the same for us. All right, that's what that passage is saying. The Calvinistic interpretation of that passage and their usage of the word foreknow in that passage is utterly false. All right, it's proven false by the grammar because all the verbs are historical verbs. They're aorist indicative verbs, right? Which means they all happened in the past, not they're happening now. All right, so there we go. All right, so let's move on. Excuse me. Let's move on to the next passage that uses this term, this verb, prognosko, or foreknow. It's in Romans 11, 2 through 4. So Paul writes this, God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. Now again, a Calvinist reading this verse says, oh, God has not cast away those he foreknew in eternity past, that he predetermined to be saved in eternity past. God has not cast them away. Therefore, they get the fifth point of TULIP, the perseverance of the saints. That, you know, once you're saved, you are always saved. You can never lose your salvation. And so they're getting that from this verse, but that's not what it's saying, right? God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. Now, how do I know he's not saying that? Because he gives examples of people that he foreknew, right? He says, or do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah? That is, God foreknew Elijah. This is the point he's making, right? How he pleads with God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed your prophets, torn down your altars, and I alone am left, and they seek my life. That's the quote. But what does the divine response say to him? God replied to Elijah, I have reserved for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So what is Paul doing in this passage? Those whom God foreknew, he's making a general statement that God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. That is, people in the past. Again, foreknew means knew previously, not knew before they existed. Right? And who are the ones God knew previously or before? The Old Testament saints. And so he gives an illustration of this. Elijah was one of those Old Testament saints, one of the prophets. So the examples he gives, which is Elijah plus 7,000 men, are men that God knew before now, or before Paul is writing his letter, not before they existed. And his examples illustrate that. All right? Okay, now let's go back to 1 Peter 1:20, the favorite verse of so-called biblical Unitarians, in order to prove that Jesus was only foreknown in this Calvinistic sense, right? For he was foreknown, prognosko, before the foundation of the world, but has appeared in these last times for the sake of you. Now, the clause, the foundation of the world, is misunderstood, but it's not necessary for me to correct that error in order to make the points that I'm making here. All right, so I have a footnote in the notes here that those of you who download the notes, you'll be able to go to another series of articles I wrote, which shows why this clause, foundation of the world, should be translated the overthrow of the world or the casting down of the world, and refers to the curse put on the world, not to the creation of the world. All right, so that's a subtle difference. Excuse me. But it's not really that critical to the points that I want to make to refute the biblical Unitarians. All right, so we'll just set that aside for now. If you want to dig deeper into that, go into the footnotes, and I have a link to my articles on that topic. All right, so let's get back to this. For he was, that is Jesus in the context, was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but has appeared in these last times for you. Now, if we apply the consistent meaning of prognosko that we have shown by every other place it appears in the Bible, both in the Septuagint and in the New Testament, we have shown that it refers to having prior knowledge of someone, not before they exist, but before when the writer is writing this down or the speaker is speaking. All right, that's what it means. If we apply that meaning, that's like we saw with Paul, right? His accusers knew him from the first, knew him from his youth. It's a knowing prior to the present. And it's a knowing of a person or knowing a person who actually exists in every single case. All right. So let's apply that to 1 Peter 1:20. If that's the case, then the Son of God was personally known to the Father, assuming that he's talking about the knowledge being the Father's knowledge, as he was God's agent in creating the world. So of course he was known previously. He was God's agent, right? And what does the statement say? He was foreknown even before the foundation of the world or the casting down of the world, but has appeared in these last times for the sake of you, or for your sake, right? So what is he saying here? He was foreknown. Does the word appeared refer to somebody coming into existence, or does it refer to somebody being shown that already existed? Well, clearly that's the case, right? So here again, Buzzard is completely overlooking the sense of the word appeared. All right, well, let's skip down here. I pointed out that the clause foundation of the world is wrong, and again, I have the footnote here that you can, it's footnote 3 here in my letter, or my notes, and I have that down here at the bottom. You can go there and read that set of articles. All right. Now, if we understand the foundation of the world as being the casting down of the world, or the overthrow of the world, then the referent here is not God knowing his Son personally before the creation, but rather Adam's experiential knowledge of the Son in the Garden of Eden. All right, we saw that in previous sections. We saw that even John, you know, the New Testament repeatedly says no one has ever seen God at any time. Right, Paul says no one has seen or can see God. John 1:18, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he is the one who has declared him or made him known. And so that passage is simply saying that these appearances of the one called God or Yahweh in the Old Testament, that when he appeared to persons that actually saw him, John is saying that was the Son whom they saw, and Peter's simply affirming that here in 1 Peter 1:20, that it was the Son who was the one interacting with Adam. So what is this verse actually saying? Let's go back here. If we take the clause, the foundation of the world, to refer to the overthrow or the casting down of the world when Adam sinned and he was driven from the Garden of Eden, if we take it that way, and we take the word foreknown as it's used everywhere else in the Bible, as being to know someone who existed, to know them personally in the past, then what is this verse actually saying? For he, that is Christ, the Son, was known before, personally known before the overthrow of the world, that is when Adam was thrown out of the gardens. So what would that refer to? It referred to Adam's interaction with the Son of God in the Garden of Eden. That's what that's talking about, right? So what Peter is saying is he was even known, Christ was even known by Adam before he sinned, but has appeared. The word appeared means to be made manifest. It means someone who already exists to be shown or made apparent to everyone. And so what he's saying is Christ was hidden. You know, we talked in the previous sections, we've talked about Paul and the mystery that was concealed from all the rulers and so forth. And if had they known this mystery or this hidden wisdom, as Paul refers to it in 1 Corinthians 1 and 2, if they had known who this was, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. So Paul is identifying Christ there with the hidden wisdom of Proverbs 8. So he existed before, but he was hidden from Israel. He was hidden from the rulers and the scribes and the intellectuals and the scholars of Israel. He was hidden, but he was revealed to a few. And Paul goes on to say in 1 Corinthians 1 and 2 that all this has been revealed to the apostles by the Spirit. That is Christ's relationship to all of these Old Testament people and his existence in times past, his interaction with humanity in times past. Paul says that was revealed through the Spirit to the apostles in that passage. All right, so the passage is actually saying he was foreknown by Adam. He was known intimately by Adam. Adam walked with him in the garden. He's the one who commanded Adam not to eat from the tree, and he's the one who came and after Adam sinned, pronounced the curse, and the one who made clothing out of animal skins to cover Adam and Eve. That was the Son. But he has appeared, that is made manifest, that is in human flesh now, because the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, right? As John says in John 1, and as Philippians chapter 2 says that he became in the likeness of men. All right, so he appeared in these last times for the sake of you. All right, so now Anthony Buzzard's appeal to Calvin's ghost. Anthony Buzzard and Biblical Unitarians generally are haunted by John Calvin's ghost, because while the vast majority of Biblical Unitarians, and I know for sure Anthony Buzzard is not a Calvinist, he does not accept Calvinism, but he appeals to Calvin's interpretation of critical passages that are supposedly proof texts for Calvinism. He appeals to those passages and to the Calvinist interpretation of this word, prognosko, or prognosis. He appeals to those in order to make God's prior knowledge, or in this case, Adam's prior knowledge, or in a relationship with Christ, to make it just a figment of God's imagination in eternity past, as opposed to his actual existence and being known personally. All right. So like a good Calvinist, Buzzard claims that this verse shows that all Christians were known in the plan of mind of God, thus predestined to salvation. He gets that from verses 1 and 2 of 1 Peter chapter 1, but those verses don't say that. Right? They don't say that because he's misinterpreting the word foreknowledge there, prognosis, in that passage. The elect are chosen by God after they exist. This is the critical point, right? The elect are chosen, not in eternity past. They're chosen by God after they exist because he knows the hearts and thoughts of all people. 1 Kings 8:39 makes that statement. There's many other passages in scripture that show that to be the case as well, right? God knows the thoughts, intents of the hearts. So here's another point that debunks Calvinism's interpretation of all these passages and thus also debunks Anthony Buzzard's borrowing that interpretation in order to interpret 1 Peter 1:20. God rejects the proud but gives grace to the humble. You know, this anytime you deal with a Calvinist and they talk about how God has predetermined in eternity past before someone exists based on some mysterious will that cannot be known by us, that he predetermines to save some and burn the rest for all eternity, even before they make their first choice, even before they take their first breath as a baby, their destiny is determined. If you run into Calvinists, you need to point out Proverbs 3:34, which is quoted in James 4:6 and 1 Peter 5:5. It's quoted twice in the New Testament. That God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. What does that do? It tells us the criteria that God uses to judge whom he's going to elect and give his grace to. Right? Irresistible grace is one of the points of Calvinism. Well, God doesn't give grace based on a predetermined plan or predetermined knowledge of individual people. He gives grace to those who are humble presently. They are humble. He resists the proud. You want to know how God decides who's going to be saved and who's going to be lost? There it is, right there. He resists the proud and he gives grace to the humble. And James goes on, when he's quoting that, and he goes on to say, therefore, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. Right? So there you go. You want to know who's going to be saved? Who will be saved? Those who humble themselves. Right? In order to accept God's gift. Also, we have several scriptures here, listed here, that clearly show how one can receive the gift of eternal life by their choice. Right? Deuteronomy 4:29, 1 Chronicles 28:9, 2 Chronicles 15:2, Hebrews 11:6. All of these verses say that if you seek God with all your heart, you will find him. He will be found by you. He'll make himself known to you if you seek him with all your heart. So those who seek him with all their heart find him. Those who do not seek him with all their heart do not find him. All right? So this is how those are chosen by God. This is how the elect are determined. By God's knowing the hearts and thoughts of all men as they are choosing what they choose. And he chooses those who truly humble themselves and seek after God, and he saves those, right? He hasn't predetermined who's going to be saved and who's going to be lost based on some mysterious criteria that nobody can figure out, right? That's the Calvinist view. It's utterly false. It destroys the message of the gospel, and it takes man's free will completely out of the equation. It makes God a liar in passages like the very last verses in the New Testament in Revelation 22, where it says the Spirit and the bride say, come. Let him who hears say, come. And let him who is thirsty take of the water of life freely. Right? It's come. The invitation is open to all. 2 Peter 2, Peter says that God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. If God chooses before people even exist, before they make their first breath, if he chooses who is to be saved and who is to be lost, then God is a liar when it says he desires that all to be saved. So God is schizophrenic. He desires all to be saved, but he decides, predetermines to throw the majority of humanity into flames and burn them for all eternity, according to Calvinists. All right, it's completely wrong. Well, this is the problem with biblical Unitarians. They're trying to straddle the fence. They're grabbing, they're picking and choosing different things. Their system is not coherent at all. Their system is self-contradictory. They don't for the most part, do not believe in Calvinism, but they don't mind borrowing Calvinistic concepts, which are used to prove so-called Calvinism. They don't mind borrowing those concepts and then applying them to Jesus Christ and his pre-existence to claim that, you know, just, you know, supposedly as Calvinists claim that all Christians were predetermined in the mind of God before they ever were, before even creation, and therefore Jesus, since the same language is used of Jesus, he only was a figment of God's imagination before the foundation of the world, right? He didn't exist in any time until his birth in Bethlehem. That's their view. All of that is shown to be utterly false. You can take it out with the trash. When you take out Calvinism and dump that in the dumpster, you can take out this argument also from biblical Unitarians, which is really the basis and the foundation of all of their claims about pre-existence being only in the mind and plan of God, which is really the cornerstone of their entire system. All right, it's utterly false. And again, like I said, their system is not coherent because of these things. All right, so anyway, God bless. That's all for this one. And I know it's been a long time since I made a video. It's been, I think, a couple of months since I made a video. I'm going to try to kick out a couple more before too long in a much shorter space. And I'm thinking probably two or three more videos, and this entire section on God and His Son is going to be completed, and we'll move on to something else. All right. Anyway, God bless. See you next time.